as giving in to the rage washed away the soul-crushing sadness for a few moments. And this was a good day. This was what a good day felt like now. She surprised herself by laughing. "Yes?" Kumpar asked. "I was just thinking," she said. "That's the first time, since I don't know when, that something was afraid of a human." Chapter 21. The game had gotten bigger. Only no, that wasn't true. The game had always been bigger, and now Daffid wasn't the only one who felt it. "I'm not scared," he thought. "I'm curious. I'm not scared. I'm curious. It isn't fear. It's curiosity." He took a deep breath and blew it out as he walked. The path to the librarian's quarters was almost familiar now. He felt his mind starting to set landmarks. The archway that led out of his cathedral. The highway of guards and servants of the Carracks. The turn where the wall had a streak that looked like verdigris. The passage that led to the lake, and the one with the webs. The turn that took him from wherever else the great passage went, and bent him toward the librarian of the human moiety. It was all so large, so solid, that he could almost forget how high above the planet's surface they were. The window in their quarters looked out higher than a transport would fly on Agian. All of this was in one ziggurat out of dozens just like it that they could see. Not scared. Curious. How did they build that? What kinds of materials could they have invented to make something this astounding? Had it been the Carracks themselves? Some other species? Had they found it in place and appropriated it? There was so much history, so many stories, and he wanted to hear them because they were fascinating, not just because his life depended on it. He heard Carrick's voices before he reached the room, and even untranslated, he knew the librarian from the other. It wasn't the reedy, pleasant voice of the translator box, but it was the peculiar whistle and trill that went with it. And then the other, lower and harsher. Daffid waited outside while the conversation went on. He didn't know what the Carracks would do if he interrupted, but since the worst could be fatal, he was fine with giving them time. He was curious because he chose to be. It didn't make him stupid. The Carracks that lumbered out of the room was large, but also weirdly graceful. The feeding arms tucked into its body were darker than usual, and the huge fighting forelegs had streaks of red on them as vibrant as a butterfly's wings. By instinct, Daffid bowed and pressed his hands to the floor as it passed. The librarian was calm and still when he went in. Only its back legs shifted back and forth, swaying its body, but gently. The wide, dark eyes clicked to him, and away, and back again. "If I have come at an inappropriate time, I can come back later," he said, and the square at the librarian's neck churred and stuttered. "Your errand in coming determines whether your timing is appropriate," the reedy voice said, and Daffid thought he heard some amusement in it. That might only have been his imagination. "I wanted to make a proposal," he said, stepping into the room. "If it is permitted, I would like to come here with you and learn about the Carracks." The librarian was silent for long enough that Daffid was starting to worry. Its back leg shifted. "To what end?" "The test is whether we're useful. If we understood what you needed or wanted, there is a possibility we'd be better able to make ourselves useful." It was true as far as it went. It was also the best plan he could think of to be where the other survivors of Agian would come. He'd found his way here. It made sense that others might have too. He wasn't certain that connection was something the librarian would want, though, so he kept that to himself. The librarian froze, its back legs braced the way he'd seen them do in the plaza on Agian, and the powerful forelegs rose off the ground like a prelude to violence. Daffod dropped to the floor, spreading his arms and trying to think what he had done that could have given offense. After a long, tense moment, the carex lowered its forelegs. When it spoke, the voice was the same as ever. "Possibility is irrelevant. You are useful, or you are not. I only meant that we could do a better job serving the carex if an animal does not choose its..." The translator paused for a fraction of a second. "Essential nature and place in society. I apologize. I am young. I'm still learning." The librarian shuddered. A long, rising motion that seemed to start at its core and radiate out. "There is nothing else." "No," he said. He rose and backed away. The floor was worked with little hexagons with fine, dark lines running across them like circuitry. He'd never noticed that before. When he reached the hallway, he sat back against the wall and rested his head on his knees. The trembling came and went. The muttering and deep, rolling trills of Carrick's voices in the distance was like hearing an endless wave breaking against a stone beach. Nausea haunted the back of his throat, but as long as he didn't move, it didn't get worse. Once, when he'd been very young, a section of cliffside that he'd been standing on sloughed away as he stepped off it, tumbling to a distant canyon floor. The sense of having barely avoided death was the same now. "All right," he said to the empty air. "So, not that. Right." But even in the middle of his adrenaline shudders, a part of him thought, why not that? Yes. Yes, the Carrex had rejected the idea, powerfully. But why powerfully? And why reject it? Daffod breathed deeply, slowly, and replayed the conversation in his head. Everything he'd said, everything the librarian had replied. He imagined it again and again, not trying to analyze it. Not yet. If he could commit it to memory, he could review it again later. The thing now was not to forget. The translator had paused, stumbled on something like it had a hard time putting some particular thought into human terms. What had that been? Essential nature and place in society. He repeated the phrase aloud a half dozen times, but couldn't find anything in it. He sighed, hauled himself to his feet, and started the long walk back to the safety of the work group's quarters. The wide main corridor was more crowded today than it had been during his previous visits. He kept looking between the alien bodies, Rakund, Soft Lothark, and the lumbering, enameled bulk of Carrick soldiers, hoping to catch a glimpse of a human face. The last vestiges of his cunning plan as it failed. No one appeared, just rank after rank of Carrick's soldiers. As he came to the archway that led back to the cathedral and the abandoned lab, he shifted to looking for the night drinkers. He was a human alone, after all. Being out was a risk. He resented that. He wanted to sit in his little niche the way he had before and watch the strange and wonderful bodies, evolutionary solutions to environments he could barely imagine, walk and lumber and float. He remembered the hours he'd spent and how lonely he'd felt, how cut off from the others. Now he was going back to where everyone was all the time together, and he resented the change. One of the Carrick's guards came out from the cathedral as he was heading in. Its shell was a brilliant green, its forelegs thick and paler than the average, but the things that caught Dafydd's attention were three pale stripes, like bracelets. One of the librarians had had the same marks and in the same place. A caste mark, maybe. But where had he seen it? Oh yes, it had been the librarian for the hallway crows. The one that had led Dafydd to his own librarian the first time, when its charge had been throwing a tantrum by the wall of the cathedral. Dafydd's steps slowed before he knew why he was slowing. The hallway crows, standoffish and isolated but common, had been there from the first day the humans had arrived. He'd seen them on the way in from the landing pad and the presentation of the prisoners. But he couldn't recall seeing one lately. Not, maybe, since the day he'd approached their librarian. He walked again, his attention sharp for night drinkers or other threats, but also looking to see whether, standing alone in the shadows and corners, there were any hallway crows left. From the time he'd stepped into the cathedral to his arrival at the workgroup's wide doorway, his count never got above zero. "It was astounding," Kumpar said, gesturing expansively as Dafydd rolled the door shut. "One moment she was our well-loved Jessen, studious and meek, and the next the spirit of vengeance. Welcome back, young Alcor. You've missed the Great War Expedition." "He's exaggerating," Jessen said from the kitchen, but she was smiling. It was strange to see her smiling. "But we have found the Night Drinker's lab. Maybe their nest, too. It's hard to say." "Where are Else and Cynia?" Dafydd asked.
"Sleeping. What did you get?"
Tanner asked from where he squatted beside the resonance imager. Dafydd shrugged. An anomaly, in translation. A pattern of arm marks. A rejection. "Less than I'd hoped. You?" Tanner shifted his weight. Around them, the common area was barely controlled chaos. Power cables snaked from holes ripped in the kitchen counters to the jagged-edged lab equipment. The chairs and couches that had been scattered through the space were shoved against the walls to make room, and one wall was covered with pages of notes and sketched-in tables of reaction times and metabolite levels. The dining table was entirely covered with sacrificed berries, their skins peeled back and pinned down to expose the bare pulp inside. "We've lost a lot of progress," Tanner said, "but I think we'll get through it faster the second time."
"The initial assay is that Jessen's medication is non-toxic to the hosts," Kumpar said. "Our little friend should be able to produce it at a therapeutic concentration without any additional cooking down on our part."
"If we can get them to express it at all," Jessen said. Kumpar shooed the comment away. "That's the simple part."
"It's not simple," Tanner said, and then, "it's also not harder than what we were already doing."
Dafydd's head felt full. He wondered what the others would think if he told them that the librarian seemed on the edge of killing him. If they'd think he was playing up the story for attention. If they'd believe him.
"What can I do to help?" he asked.
The light from the great window changed slowly, shifting its angle and color until deep blue shadows spilled across the floor. The work was familiar, prepping specimens, reading metabolic activity from heat and waste products, and how quickly they exhausted free oxygen from the air. Cynia came out, made herself a meal, and sat at the table among the flayed animals. Else appeared a little after, hair disarrayed by her nap, and exhaustion still in the darkness under her eyes. Jessen and Kumpar retold the story of chasing off the night drinkers again for the new audience. Dafydd recounted his failed approach to the librarian, and the soldier Carrick's with the banded arm, and the missing hallway crows. Tanner worked with the steady, unrelenting pace of a long-distance runner. The pattern that their lives had built since arriving in the prison had been broken by the attack, and the new version of their days was still finding itself. Who they were to each other after Irina's death was different, too. David saw it in the way Tanner focused on the work instead of on managing the schedule for everyone around him. He saw it in Kampar's brewing fresh tea for people, whether they had asked for it or not. In Ricker's unspoken inclusion in the work. His exile, part of a social order that no longer existed. For Daffid, it felt like equal parts relaxation and mourning. The Carricks had made an imperfect model of their old lives for them here. One place to sleep, another to work. Tanner had taken a whip hand to it, taking comfort in the tasks because it was the only control over his own life left to him. Even cutting Ricker out had been a way to keep continuity with the past, when connection to the past was just an illusion. They were all letting the illusion of control and continuity go now, or else it was slipping away despite them. It was full dark outside, and Kampar and Sinia had retired to their rooms when Daffid put the last sample of pulp into the resonance imager. All right, I think I'm done for the day. I'll see you all in the morning. Ricker? Tanner said. Can you keep an eye on that? I want the readings when it's at a quarter and halfway through the run. On it, Ricker said, moving over to take the seat Daffid was leaving. Then, leaning in toward Daffid and nodding toward the team lead, I'm sure he'll sleep at some point. You think I can't do this while I'm asleep? Tanner said. It was strange to hear him joke with Ricker. It was strange to hear him joke at all. And there was a sorrow at the back he didn't understand yet. In his room, Daffid showered. The weariness wasn't physical, but his mind felt like he was stuffing too much straw into a too small sack. The feeling that there was something important, something he almost understood, was like change in the air before a storm. His mind shifted from Jessen and Ricker and Kampar chasing the night drinkers to the missing hallway crows, to the librarian's near rage. Nothing fit together, but he was certain that something would if he could just find the right perspective. Dream was just touching his mind, drawing him off into memories of things that he halfway knew hadn't happened, when his door opened and then softly closed. He blinked, raising himself up on his elbows. What is it? What's wrong? Nothing, El said as she sat on the edge of his mattress. Shh. Nothing's wrong. In the near darkness, her face was just a familiar curve, a little reflection where her eyes rested. He rolled to his side and she shifted into the space he'd left for her. What is it? The moment of silence sounded like a smile. She took his hand, guiding it. He lost his train of thought. Then, what do you think it is? Else, he said. I'll leave if you want me to, she said. But we don't have very much left. Not much time. Or safety. Or reason to count on tomorrow. I don't want to sacrifice anything good in my life right now. I need the things that sustain me. If this isn't one, I understand. But if it is... He felt her shrug. He closed his eyes, and it didn't make much difference. Daffid's mind moved the consequences of what he said next, like he was shifting pieces on a game board. Did Tanner see you come in? If you stay, what will it do to him? How does this complicate things with the others? She brushed her fingers across the back of his hand. The sound of her skin against his was like a soft wind in the desert. All right. All right? Please, stay. The swarm is at war with itself. The dead girl is repulsed, angry, cutting in her judgment. Everything about this is gross. Everything. It's a status fuck. Finding the man with the most pull in the group and diving into his lap, it's disgusting. Else, or what remains of Else, doesn't speak. But its hurt and defensiveness is a tightness at the jaw, a hardness in the lips. The swarm feels her reaching for the echo of the dead girl, searching for some intimacy to hit back at. But there is very little of Amir left. Daffod stretches beside its body, another vulnerable man, but with a very different meaning. It has loosened the reins on its stolen flesh. Let the cascade of nerve impulses and chemical signals flow where they would have gone without its presence. It was aware intellectually of the ways that physical pleasure reinforces the cues associated with it. A name, a scent, an identity. Now it is watching those associations form in itself in real time. It is feeling what sex can do to a human brain, what longing and need and the slaking of desire can do. The dead girl isn't wrong. The process is undignified. Else, seeing herself through the other one's perspective, is humiliated. When she tells herself it wasn't her, it was the swarm, no one believes her. There are too many memories of other times, other moments when she lost interest in one mate and favored another whose fortunes were on the rise. It is something she has tried not to know about herself. She is ashamed, and the swarm feels her shame with indulgence. It is such a small sin, such an inconsequential flaw in the grand scheme of things. Even as the other one recoils, the swarm finds itself considering Else Yanin with kindness, consolation, something even a little akin to love. "You said something before," it says. Daffod Alcor takes a deep breath, and its head rises with his ribs.
"Yeah?"
"About soldier Carracks. You said there were more of them."
"There were."
"How many, do you think?"
"I don't know. Dozens, but this place is so big. There could be thousands, and I wouldn't know it. Or maybe there weren't really any more than usual, and I just stumbled past a troop movement."
"Maybe," it says. But it knows that isn't true. Even with only its passive senses, it has found traces, hints. A few extra parts per billion of a particular scent molecule. A deepening of the prison building's subliminal hum. There have been more Carrick ships dropping down through the veil of drones that locks the planet's sky. The Great Hive is stirring. Changes are coming. And changes mean only one thing to the Carracks and the Swarm. The war. The war is coming. The Carracks are preparing another wave of attacks, and it alone of all the opposing forces knows. Its mission tugs at it like a hunger it can't feed. The sexual satiety helps, but even now the restlessness is growing again. It has to find a way to pass on all it has learned, all it is learning. It has to find a way off the planet, out from under the Carrick's world palace, to some place with gaps in the security. This moment of improbable calm, these people in the little bubble of time and space and safety that they've made with each other despite the death and violence around them, is beautiful because it cannot last. It's beautiful because even with all they've seen and experienced, they don't know how lucky they have been. Or how badly things can go. "This is for you," Else thinks. "You blame me,
But this sex is for you. You wanted it. I control nothing now. I am a fading observer in my own body. Why do you want this? The swarm has no answer for this query. It is a very human thing to want without knowing why. The swarm considers. Then it shifts, pressing its skin against its lover, reveling in the small, sensual pleasure, taking comfort, while comfort can still be had.
Chapter 22. Tanner tried not to notice, and the effort was a kind of failure. Else was her own person. When they'd been together, it had been understood that the relationship was secondary to the work. If she'd gotten a more promising opportunity, they would have parted ways without anger or recrimination. It wouldn't have been a betrayal of anything. He hadn't proposed some kind of permanent pair bond, and she hadn't expected him to. The truth was, he hadn't considered why she was with him. It just seemed natural at the time, and he'd gone with it. There were some ethical issues, yes. He was team lead, and she worked for him. But he hadn't used the fact to manufacture willingness that wasn't there. He didn't think he had. But now she'd slipped down the hallway and into Daffod Alcor's room, and he wasn't perfectly certain of anything. Maybe this was some kind of revenge she was exacting on him. Maybe he'd done something to deserve it. Maybe it didn't have anything to do with him, and his work now was to understand that he'd always been a minor character in her story, and that maybe she'd been only a small part of his, however it had felt at the time. The tightness at the base of his ribs, the ache in his cheeks, where he was unconsciously frowning, the uncanny pull that the hallway had, drawing his gaze any time he let his focus slip, they were annoyances. The sting he felt, remembering how recently he had cried himself to sleep in Else's arms, well, he had more important concerns than making peace with humiliation. Still, part of him wished that the lab hadn't been taken apart and moved here. Back at Irvian, he could have dealt with an empty apartment by abandoning it. He could have walked through the streets in daylight or by night and made his way to his labs and lost himself in the work. If the night drinkers hadn't screwed things up for him, he could have done the same here. But that was what made prison prison. He couldn't leave when he wanted to. His best option was to cultivate a focus so intense that it drove out the awareness of emotion, even where it couldn't exercise the emotions themselves. If he hated Daffod Alcor, if he resented Else for shifting her affections, at least he could be oblivious about it. The little knot turtle scrabbled in its box, exploring the space with its blunt beak-like nose. It was the fifth specimen they'd had. Three of the others had starved to death because the Carracks didn't provide food for them. The other one, Tanner had tried making a mash of the berry's silicate pulp, figuring that it was better than feeding the little animal nothing. It had violently emptied its digestive tract and died within half a day. He was going to let this one starve. It was bad luck for it that he had more pressing concerns than making food. The centrifuge hummed to itself, the readout on its side counting down the seconds that remained in the run, and estimating the density and separation of molecules in the column. Outside the window, the sky was starting to reach toward dawn. Another night gone without sleep. There was a word he'd come across once that meant the joy that someone took in self-destroying behavior, like the fraction of pleasure that came from drinking that would be lost if the alcohol didn't harm you. It applied to work, too. He didn't remember what the word was, though. Only the idea behind it.
Breakfast time. Can I make you anything? Kumpar asked as he ambled out of the darkness, his hair still slick from the shower.
Coffee, Tanner said. Alas, there is no coffee.
Tea.
Last of the tea was 2 days ago.
A stimulant of some kind.
Do you find oatmeal stimulating?
Fine. Kumpar rattled the pans in the little kitchen area. The seconds counted down on the centrifuge. Tanner's attention slid toward Daffet Alcor's bedroom door and then got yanked back away. His eyes felt gritty and dry.
Sleep at all?
Napped between assay runs, Tanner said. I'm fine. The centrifuge chimed, the hum deepening as the mechanism slowed and going silent when it stopped. Tanner removed the column. The band with active agent was red as a cherry and about as thick as his fingernail. It would have to be enough. He grabbed a needle from the sampling kit and drew it off until the redness was almost completely gone, then added it to a glass where a half ounce of bright red fluid already waited. From the kitchen, Kumpar gestured to the crimson liquor with his chin.
Jessen, should be enough for 3 days at her old levels, Tanner said, answering the unspoken question. I'm not sure about the uptake, though. There's some other things in that same layer of the soup, but purification based on something besides specific gravity is a pain in my butt. Hopefully it works. Doesn't do anything worse than give her a little gas, and we can call it a win.
Impressive, Kumpar said.
Yeah, well, I'm good at what I do.
He poured the leavings of the spin into the waste container.
And are you all right?
Kumpar's voice had a depth to it, a gravity he didn't usually employ. It was enough to tell Tanner that the subject had changed and what it had changed to. Kumpar was standing in the kitchen, waiting for the water to boil, his expression calm and also oddly implacable. With the curly beard he was growing, he looked like a loving father who was insisting that the uncomfortable conversation happen and that it happen now.
Should I be? Tanner asked. I'm not passing judgment. I've been accused of being fickle myself. I've had a lot of love affairs end, and it's always different. Often messy, rarely easy.
Am I being an asshole about it?
Tanner heard the challenge in his voice, the I dare you to tell me this is my fault, that echoed the irrational sense that he'd done something wrong. Kumpar added a dash of salt to the water.
You're pouting. But I think I would too in your position.
Are they being assholes then?
Yes. But also I don't know how they could be more discreet, given our living situation. The etiquette books I've read don't cover sex in a prison camp.
Tanner walked across the room, the window at his back, and Kumpar before him. He felt the weariness in his joints. He was going to have to rest soon. He couldn't imagine going to sleep.
I don't choose to feel hurt. If I could just decide not to, I would absolutely just decide not to. But it's not up to me. My brain is doing a million things without asking me first. That's normal, and usually it's fine. Right now, I hate it. And hating it doesn't change it either.
Can you imagine what it would be like if we were in control of our hearts? Kumpar said. If we could decide not to be angry or possessed by lust or afraid?
Yes, Tanner said, surprised by the insight. Yes, I can. I imagine it would make us ideal servants. I wonder if the Carricks...
The wide door to the hallway shuddered and clanked like something had fallen against it. Tanner stopped talking and went toward it by reflex. He had only started to crack the door open when the attackers flooded in.
Small, fast bodies covered in feather-like pelts, and the screams of the night drinkers as they charged. Tonner jumped back, stumbling over the power cables and falling onto his right shoulder hard enough to numb the arm. Kampar was a shout off somewhere to his left, and one of the night drinkers leaped at him. Tonner kicked, struck the softness of a body, and pushed it back hard. The creature dropped something round and soft as a balloon filled with liquid, but the color and texture of paper. Tonner scrambled to his feet. Half a dozen of the animals were in the common area and kitchen, all of them with teeth bared and the strange little orbs in their hands. A dark-pelted one, larger than the rest, took position on the dining table, screamed a high, trilling shriek, and threw. The orb flew through the air, just missing Kampar's head, and splashed open along the kitchen wall. Acid, Tonner thought. They're throwing acid at us. He grabbed the nearest thing he could find, a length of unused power cable, and whipped it at them. The rooms were a chaos of bodies and movement, and he shifted and struck out without plan or strategy. All he cared about was violence, hurting the things that were trying to hurt him. He felt himself shouting, but he didn't hear it. One of the attackers jumped on the centrifuge, its leg knocking against the cup where he'd put Jessen's medicine, and Tonner grabbed it by the leg, ripping it through the air, hammering it into the resonance scanner. Something bit the back of his thigh, tiny teeth clamping deep into the muscle, but he slammed the animal in his hand down two more times before the pain in his leg dropped him to his knees. Before he could grab it, the little bastard moved, letting go and jumping away. With a lightning-fast grab, Kampar snatched it out of the air and hurled it at the wall. It was a sign of his strength that the creature smashed into the wall and crumpled to the floor like a sack filled with wet rags. Kampar was shouting too, the veins standing out in his neck, his eyes wide with terror. Tonner tried to get up and slipped back down onto his butt. There was blood all over the floor, and he realized, with surprise, it was coming out of his leg. He was about to ask Kampar for help when something hit his shoulder and splashed across his neck and face. They got me. I'm dead. There was a kind of relief in the thought. Jessen barreled by him, a crowbar in her hand, and her hair streaming out behind her like she'd become a human pennant. Ricker was there too, and Else and Daffid. A clump of the night drinkers backed away toward the open door, their teeth bared. Then Jessen shouted, a wordless battle cry, and rushed at the little bastards. They scattered, but not quickly enough. Tonner caught one by the leg as it darted past him. He raised it over his head and thrust it down to the bronze-green metal floor. Two more orbs struck him, splashing the noxious gel on his shoulder and injured leg. And then the night drinkers fled, disappearing into the corridor. In Tonner's hand, the monkey he'd managed to grab spasmed, shook, and went still. Kampar turned in a circle, a pry bar out before him like a policeman's baton, ready for violence. The liquid, whatever it was, glistened on his arm and belly where he'd been struck. "Are you all right?" the big man asked, and sound returned like God had turned the world's volume back on. The voices of the others were a cacophony, everyone talking over everyone else. High, indignant shrieks came from the corridor, growing more distant by the second. Tonner grabbed the edge of the counter and hauled himself to his feet. Daffid slammed the door closed so hard it seemed like it might break the housing. Jessen stood facing the closed door, air hissing through her teeth and the whites showing all around her eyes, fists clenched like a dare that anyone try to open it again. "Showers," Tonner said, already limping his way toward the back. "Anyone who got this on them, strip and shower. Do it now." His room was farther,
so he ducked into Irina's and didn't take the time to shut the door behind him. The gel adhered to his skin, cold and burning at the same time. He threw the water tap open and stepped in as the red goo that always came before the water sprayed out. He should have thought about that. Who knew what chemical reaction mixing the crimson cleanser with the night drinker's weapon might have? Too late to do anything about it now. He stripped his clothes off as the spray became hot water sluicing over him. Was the chemical in his eyes? Was it going to blind him? Was his skin starting to melt and slough away? He rubbed his skin vigorously in the hot water and tried not to imagine the flesh coming off in his hands. The panic started to fade. He stood in the flow of water for a slow count of 100, then another one. Then he shut it off and stepped out. The skin where the gel had stuck was red and raised, but only a little painful to the touch, not worse than a sunburn. He waited, watching for blistering or weeping, but nothing came. When he pulled on a fresh tunic, one that Irina had left behind when she died, it hurt. He pulled it off again and made do with just trousers. They were stupid. They should have drilled a spy hole in the door. They should have made rules about opening it. A stronger latch, a lock. They were at war, and they had treated the rooms like they were safe, like violence wouldn't spill out from the cathedral. And they knew better. They all knew better. He knew better, and he hadn't done anything about it. Too focused on other things, on Jessen's medicine, on Daffod, on Else. He sat on the bed. There was old blood on the sheets. In a different part of his life, he would have gone to Else now. He would have unburdened himself to her and taken whatever comfort she had to offer. Instead, he sat, fingers laced together, body bent forward, and waited without knowing what he was waiting for. He was tired. He was exhilarated. He was frightened. The knock at the door was gentle, almost apologetic. Cynia looked in, her expression concerned. "Are you feeling all right? Has the alien's balloon goo killed you?" she meant. "Everything's fantastic," he said. He tried it as a joke, but it came out meaner than funny. He hauled himself to his feet. "I'm fine, thanks. How's Kumpar?" "Skin irritation. A little blistering where it's worst, but it doesn't seem to be progressing. Let's take a look." The common area looked slightly less organized than it had before the violence. Someone had jammed one of the chairs into the wide door's track, barring it. Dark stains marked the walls and floor where the gel sacks had ruptured and spilled. The pan Kumpar had been using for his oatmeal was on the floor. The water spilled around in a puddle. Something stank like compost and blood, but he didn't figure out what it was until he saw the others crowded around the dining table. Kumpar had also opted for going shirtless. The skin at his chest and belly was swollen, and half a dozen small white blisters were forming to the left of his navel. Else, standing beside him, looked up at Tonner. Her eyes met his, and she shifted her weight like she was about to walk toward him. Tonner shook his head once. "You don't get to worry about me." She shifted back. If there was a little shame in her eyes, that was fine. On the table, one of the night drinkers lay. The stink was its blood. Jessen had begun with textbook cuts, pulling back the skin and tacking it to the tabletop. Unmade, the thing looked less like a monkey. Instead of a bony ribcage, there was a sheath of what looked like yellow cartilage with interleaved sections that could slide against each other. Its abdomen was taken up by a single, undifferentiated gray mass, but its chest, underneath the cartilage sheaths, was as complex as anything Tanner had ever seen. "Look at this gas exchange system," Jessen said, lifting a pinkish organ with a fork. "That's got to be a gas exchange system, right? Look at it."
"Unidirectional," Ricker said. "Either they have a terrifically inefficient metabolism, or they're used to a low oxygen environment."
"What reeks like last week's salad?" Tanner said, stepping up to the table. The night drinker's blood had run over the edge of the table.
"Its gut contents make it look like an herbivore," Jessen said. "Which, weird, I would have thought those were obligate carnivore teeth."
Tanner scratched his chin. He was a little dizzy. Maybe tired. Maybe bottoming out after his adrenaline rush. Maybe reacting to whatever noxious chemistry had been in the gel sacks. But along with it, he felt a rush of amusement and affection. The enemy had come, bent on murder. They'd broken into their home, assaulted them, and the first impulse of the team was to see what they could learn from it. If they survived this alien hellscape, it would be because of this. Because in the face of trauma and violence, what they wanted first was to know, to understand. He stepped away, found the cup. The red fluid hadn't spilled. When he gestured to Jessen, she came over reluctantly. Her attention was on the dissection. When he put the cup in her hand, she frowned her confusion.
"Once a day," he said. "I'd probably take it with food, at least at first. I think the rest of it's inert, but might want to give it a cushion all the same." Understanding went through her slowly. Tears welled in her eyes, but she only nodded once and said, "Thank you for this."
"Back on your feet in no time," he said, and they both chuckled at the absurdity of it all.
"Tanner, have a look."
Kampar had moved away from the table, probably not the dining table anymore, not after this, and to the kitchen sink.
"How are you?"
"I itch," Kampar said. "I've itched before. As long as my skin doesn't all necrotize in the next day or two, I'll call it a victory.
What does this look like to you?"
In the sink, nestled beside the drain, one of the gel sacks lay. It reminded him of when he'd been young and dissolved all the calcium off a duck's egg by soaking it in vinegar. All that was left was the membrane, thick enough to hold the egg together and thin enough to see through. That wasn't what Kampar meant. It took a few seconds to get to the thought the big man had already had.
"It's a berry," Tanner said. "It's one of the berries."
"I think it is," Kampar said.
"That's not a surprise, is it? They're the rival team. They're going to have a bunch of the same things we do, or things that are analogous. The specimens are going to match up."
"Yes, but where we made it into a little pharmaceutical printer, they made a bioweapon."
Kampar's smile was wide and slow. He was waggling his eyebrows. Tanner didn't get it. And then he did. He looked at the pale little blob. When the night drinkers thought of something deadly, something to erase their enemies, they made bombs. When the bombs weren't enough, they made this. They made it out of the same raw materials that Tanner had, and they'd left a sample.
"All right," he said. "Jessen, when you're done poking through that mess over there, throw it out and come check the sampler and the imager. We may have knocked them around a little. If they're out of true, we'll need to tear them again." He took a breath, steeled himself. "Daffod, if you and Kampar could gather up as much of the gooey crap from the walls and floors you can get, we may not need it, but we also might. Else, if you could take this sack and prep what's in it for the imager. I had a couple runs I'm going to need to put on ice. We have three projects now. Turtle food, pharmaceutical production, weapons testing. We need to run them simultaneously, so I hope you all enjoy juggling.
To his surprise and pleasure, they chuckled, even Sinia, who didn't take joy in much anymore. Even Else, who had been his lover once and wasn't anymore. Daffod had the good sense not to push back with a counterplan of his own. Maybe Tonner was being paranoid that he'd assumed that he would.
How long has it been since you rested? Jessen asked. It took Tonner a couple seconds to focus on her. He really was spent.
But I wouldn't be able to, he said. Let's get to work.
Chapter 23. The sunlight spilled through the window of Else's bedroom and spread itself along the wall. Unseen clouds softened the edges. Daffod lay on his side, his arm under his head like a pillow, and watched her. Of all the unthinkable events in his life, the fact that the universe had put him beside this woman felt the most unlikely. Had he been in love with her before? Or had it just been a passing infatuation? Had they forged something deeper during the terrible passage from Ajian, or had they just uncovered a connection that had always been there waiting? Or, worse, was this moment as ephemeral as his old life had been? Else's eyes opened just enough for him to see the glimmer of them. Her smile was the smallest twitch of her lips.
You're thinking something, she said. I can hear the gears turning.
I am.
Cher?
They gave us rooms with windows, Daffod said. These buildings are massive. Most of the space in them will have no windows.
So?
So did they do that because humans need more sunlight than other species? Is natural light high status? Low status? An accident based on timing? Does it mean everything or nothing at all?
Why does that matter right now?
Daffod sighed, shifted. Else hooked her leg around his, pulling him against her. Her skin was warm.
I haven't figured it out yet, Daffod said.
You haven't figured out why having windows matters?
No, I mean, I don't understand the Carricks. I don't understand how they think.
Is this really your idea of afterplay? Revisiting the story of little Dot the water beetle?
You asked what I was thinking.
It would have been all right with me if it had been a little more flattering.
What's puzzling you about the Carricks today?
It's not just the windows.
Why they win? It doesn't make sense.
They're huge, strong, and difficult to kill. That seems like a good start.
Guns and explosives solved the large animal problem on Ajian centuries ago, and this is a spacefaring species. The least dangerous thing about them is that they're big and strong. It's what they are that confuses me. I thought the librarian was going to be happy to have a chance to tell us what it wanted. Why wouldn't you want your servants to be attentive and willing?
The flirtation drained out of Else's expression.
Maybe there's some cultural taboo.
These things have taken over. I mean, how many worlds would you guess are represented here? Look at all the varieties of life they have on a leash. They're doing something right. And I think about what I expect from a species or government or organization that could do this. I expect them to be open to learning. But when I made the offer, it was like I'd insulted it. I expect meaningful information flow, but these things had to be told we needed pens. I expect guidance, but there isn't any. The librarian said it was here to help us and didn't mention that the night drinkers might want us all dead. That's a big omission. They won't learn from us. They won't teach us.
In the distance, Ricker yelped. A moment later, Kampar's laughter followed. Something flew past the window, its shadow making the light flicker once. Else sat up, turned, leaned her back against the wall. The sun caught her shoulder like a tattoo inked in light. Daffod said, I don't know if there's some bit of information I'm missing, or if I have all the pieces and just can't fit them together. I keep trying to find it.
Is the way the walls don't stand square important? Is the way they walk signaling something about how their bodies work?
The librarian said, possibility is irrelevant.
What does that mean?
Can an advanced scientific species really not understand probability and inquiry down multiple paths? Why does it use Rakhunt and Soft Lothark as enforcers and not those bone horse things? It's right there, and I just can't...
Does it matter? She asked.
Yeah, probably more than anything else right now.
Else tilted her head. The light spilled onto her jaw, her cheek, set her copper-colored hair on fire.
Why? I mean, I don't disagree, but... You know, whatever you find here, it's not going to get us where we were.
He took her hand, lacing his fingers in hers.
Might help keep us where we are. We've lost a lot, but I've got some things I'd like to keep.
Jessen knew the medicine was starting to work when her fantasies changed from suicide to murder. Time had become a strange thing since the Kareks descended on Ajian and ended everything. She didn't know how long it had been, but with how stingy she'd been with her pills by the end, she was certain that even the last traces had washed out of her blood and brain. Her mind had reached its default, unmedicated state. Some days she was able to function. Some days she didn't get out of bed. And when she tried to calm her unquiet, the thing that worked was her own death. Sometimes it was drowning, sometimes it was bleeding to death, but the scenario that brought her the most peace was to replay the attack in the lab. Irina at her side, the enemy night drinkers around her. Some nights, she imagined their small arms pulling a rope around her neck and cutting off her windpipe, the darkness flowing in at the edges of her vision until there was nothing left. Some nights she imagined a second bomb and the nothingness coming in fast. And then Tanner had given her the first little glass of red liquor. It tasted bitter and salty, and it had an aftertaste that crawled up the back of her nose. For the first couple of days, she hadn't noticed a difference. And then the details of her fantasy changed. It was still the attack in the lab, the day Irina died, but her imagination shifted away from the end of her own life. She remembered the one that she'd killed, and the half-recalled, half-imagined death of the little alien had a satisfaction to it. The sense of being in control tasted like water to a woman dying from thirst. Slowly, the dreams of suicide faded. The dreams of murder bloomed. She lulled herself to sleep, conjuring up the resistance of a little neck and the crunch it made when she broke it. For Jessen, it was what passed for sanity now.
So, you feel like you're back to baseline? Cynia asked.
The older woman smiled hopefully at her, the wrinkles around her mouth and eyes bunching up. How many years did Cynia have left in her aging frame? Jessen thought about telling her that her mind always focused on death these days, but at least it wasn't her own now. Instead, Jessen shrugged and smiled.
They were in her bedroom.
She'd hauled in one of the couches that had been part of the common area and used it to make a little drawing room space. A little bit of privacy in their everyone in each other's lap lifestyle.
I think so, Jessen said. It's a little hard using your brain to take accurate readings of itself. Fundamentally bad data. Cinia poured them both a little more of what she was calling tea from the pan she'd brought in. They'd run out of actual tea, just like they'd stopped getting coffee and fresh produce. But it was something. The last batch of food to arrive had included a sachet of leaves that seemed too thick and unpleasant to use as spice, too sparse for a salad. So Kampar had started steeping them, and everyone called the result tea. They were minty and rich, and not quite unpleasantly bitter. That was as much as anyone hoped these days. "I was afraid I wouldn't know," Jessen said, "when it kicked in. I was worried that I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. I mean," she gestured broadly, "you're ripped from your home, put in an alien prison, almost killed," Cinia said, her tone grave but gentle. "Right?" Jessen said, and sipped her not-really-tea. The bitter aftertaste rode the edge of pungent without quite tipping over it. She drank it anyway. "But I could. It wasn't even subtle. I'm glad you're feeling better." "I'm not, though," Jessen thought. "I'm just feeling a different kind of bad." She didn't say it. She remembered a day from another lifetime when she and Irina had knocked off work at the labs a little early and gone out to a cafe for dinner. They'd had spiced chicken in fry bread, a sauce of peppers and apple, and more beer than had probably been wise. Jessen could still picture the woman she'd sat across from then, slender, pale, and bright-eyed, with long, expressive hands. They'd intended to go dancing afterward, but had instead gotten into a conversation about hybrid protein synthesis that excited them enough that they'd lost track of things. By dancing time, they were both too drunk. It was strange to try and make that memory reconcile with the life she had. So, instead, Jessen remembered killing the night drinker, feeling the impact as she swung its body, and an angry little warmth touched her. She didn't have to pretend her smile anymore, only what it was about. They talked a while longer, speculating about the work and sharing old memories, telling jokes that weren't particularly funny but made a bridge between them all the same. Cinia never mentioned her dead husband. Jessen never brought up her fear for her lost brother. It let them pretend, at least for a moment, they still had normal lives. In the main room, Tonner, Ricker, and Kampar were all standing around the resonance imager. The men all wore the same tunics and loose trousers that the Carracks had supplied, but they wore them very differently. They were small on Kampar's broad frame, seeming like something he'd have worn to the gymnasium, only with the collar plucked up to give the tunic the best possible drape. Tonner wore them like a necessity, unaware of how he looked and not interested if he did notice. Ricker rolled up his sleeves and cuffs just a little. On Asian, he always had the slightly rumpled, slightly erotic style of an unmade Sunday morning bed. Now, on the prison world of the Carracks, he still did. Daffod and Else weren't there, and everyone was pretending not to notice the fact, or its implications. Schematics of the weaponized berries were tacked up on the wall, different bio.